Part 1, Chapter 12, The Inevitability of the Way of the Cross. Once again, we recall to your consciousness the image of the stylized rose as the symbol of the cosmic septenary, the true divine planet Earth. In this regard, you should think neither of the seven planets of our solar system, nor of the various spheres of our field of life, but you should see in it solely an allusion to the holy divine Earth, as it once was and still is to this very moment. It is a system which can best be described as a system of seven globes rotating within one another and having a common center. Understandably, the ancients chose a flower, a spotless rose, lily, or lotus in order to render a beautiful image of this divine reality. Sometimes we see one flower, at others a wreath of seven flowers, always representing this one idea, the divine sevenfold earth, issuing from and eternally existing in the ineffable depths of the universe. And just as the true earth is, so must the true man also be. This is the reason why the holy flower symbolizes not only the macrocosm, but also the microcosm. In order to bring the fallen microcosm back to its original state, man must battle through and experience two processes. He must tread two paths, a path of farewell, of dissolution, of total enduristic dying, represented by a horizontal beam, and a path of new ascent, regeneration, rebirth, transfiguration, represented by the vertical beam. Thus the flower, the rose, forms an inseparable unity with the cross. The vertical beam of the cross is planted in the dark depths of the earth as proof of the glorious fact that the path of transfiguration really can be started in the present, in the dark caves of dialectics. The horizontal beam of the cross, the path of breaking with nature, has no direct connection with the natural basis of dialectics because this farewell is unnatural and regarded as an absurdity. But that which is absolute folly by the standards of ordinary natural reasoning becomes divine wisdom when we go the path of endurer. Our hands, first and foremost, are direct organs for action. When the candidate for the mysteries of Christ goes the path of endurer, his dialectical natural action is processively stopped. His hands are thus nailed to the cross. Then his feet can no longer pursue the usual daily activities. His feet want to tread the new path, the vertical path of ascent, of rising. Thus, according to the old nature, his feet too are nailed to the cross. And at the heart of the cross, erected by the candidate within himself, blooms a flower, the precious jewel in the lotus, namely, the spirit spark atom, one of the tiniest atoms. Its smallness is beyond imagination, just as, in the plant seed, the embryo of the whole plant is present, although unimaginably small. And the candidate jubilates, O precious jewel in the lotus, O rose blooming on the cross, Eloi, Eloah, Lama, Sabachthani, O Elohim, how you have glorified me. And at the end resounds the call of liberation, consummatum est, it is finished. We must tell you all this once more in order to direct your attention more urgently than ever before to the one goal of the spiritual school. To support your powers of imagination, you might, for our part, like to speak of a rose, lily, or lotus, or whatever flower you please. As long as you cling to this one goal, return to the divine earth, the immovable kingdom via the twofold path of dissolution and resurrection. We have already tried to explain that our dialectical field of life is not an absolute unity, but merely an isolated part of the cosmic septenary. Starting from this field of isolation, this macrocosmic quarantine station, the person wishing to return to his original home must tread the two paths pointed to by the cross. Then he becomes liberated, redeemed, and as proof, the rose will bloom. After all we have written, we take it that you now see that there are two fields of life. the life field of imprisonment, and the life field pristineness. Each of these life fields possesses an electromagnetic field and an atmosphere. Both the electromagnetic and the atmospheric conditions are determined by effects of natural forces. The latter, in turn, are determined by the kind of life expressing itself within the particular life field. All of us experience the electromagnetic attraction of the dialectical field of isolation in which we dwell. We are held captive by the effect of the gravitational force prevailing here. These effects constitute the walls of our earthly cell. Within this cell, there is an atmosphere which accords with our state of being due to natural laws. This is likewise a mercy because, were the atmosphere suited to us to disappear, it would become clear that we lack any organic aptitude for another atmospheric quality and therefore are unable to live in it. If you realize all this, we now pose a few important questions. Are we now attracted by that other, original electromagnetic field also? Do we perhaps breathe partly in the divine atmosphere belonging to that field? Have we any experience regarding the action of the gravitational force of the gnosis and its original prana, just as we obviously experience the effect of gravitational force pertaining to our field of isolation and inhale its atmosphere with every breath? The unequivocal answer to these questions must be absolutely not, out of the question. Perhaps you are shocked by this answer, but the Brotherhood wishes to confront you most emphatically with it to avoid any possible mystification on your part. This answer might seem to contradict the facts, as you could point out that all great messengers of the Gnosis brought us all the redeeming forces of the immovable kingdom as the universal remedy, and from world literature you could list many quotations against our point of view. We must, however, advise you to go more deeply into this problem with great sobriety and cleaning up the whirlpool of your conceptions. Many, even countless people, in our field of existence maintain that they belong to Christ, that they walk with Him, that they see and possess Him. They talk about Him daily, very seriously indeed, but they categorically fail to demonstrate the most obvious and direct proof thereof, namely, the proof of total opening of our eyes, as the Bible puts it. For, as soon as man establishes connection with the electromagnetic field and the atmosphere of the cosmic septenary, a change of a fundamental and structural nature commences and he becomes unfit to maintain himself in the field of isolation. If mankind as a whole and the pupils in the forecourt of the Rosy Cross were, at a given moment, struck by the gravitational effects of the immovable kingdom, they would be unable to respond, to react, and this contact would then be catastrophic. Are we not then an object of a Gnostic endeavor? Yes, undoubtedly, but you should see this endeavor not as an attraction, but as a calling. The Universal Brotherhood, working for fallen mankind, never approaches us with the electromagnetic potential of the cosmic septenary. Above all, because this influence would be a danger to the whole fundamental being of the dialectical state, and thus the goal could not be attained, as the people concerned do not in any way possess a suitable organic disposition to merge into another state of being. Secondly, a magnetic influence proceeding to a person fundamentally unable to respond to it always contains a factor of coercion, of dominance, and will therefore give rise to actions which do not accord with his inner state. The Brotherhood demands nothing from you of which you are incapable. It does not want to exercise any constraint on you or force you, and that is why it calls you. It calls you to self-freemasonry, and it may and can help you only to the extent that you proceed to breaking up the self. If you go 1 mile with the Brotherhood, it will give you light and strength for the next mile. But remember that for the sake of his own salvation, nobody can be exempted from self-action. The work of calling by the Universal Brotherhood concerns a wondrous radiation in our field of existence. It is a radiation wherein, and we emphatically repeat this, all magnetic elements, all factors of compulsion are absent. And yet this radiation does not leave any spirit spark entity at rest, because the spirit spark atom possesses a polarity with this radiation. Therefore, this action causes a continual stirring, a permanent feeling of being called, awakened. Just as a radio set can be tuned to a certain wavelength and reproduces what is broadcast, so the spirit spark atom, by virtue of its nature, is continuously tuned to these cosmic vibrations of the Brotherhood and reproduces them within its own system. These vibrations are present everywhere in the nature of our isolation field, speaking a special language to everyone open to them. In every age, brothers and sisters have gone out to mankind to translate this language, to make it comprehensible, to explain the sense of the calling light, and thereby, concurrently, to reinforce the effect of these cosmic rays. Thus, you will be able to imagine that many millions of people in this world are called in the full sense of the word. Most of the pupils of the spiritual school experience this call consciously. To be called, to know that one is called, to experience this in every fiber of one's being, of course brings with it, alongside all the other things, an intense bliss and a great certainty, namely, the certainty of being in possession of a spirit spark atom. There is, however, at the same time, a great danger in all this, the danger of developing a false mysticism and of the enormous delusion which can be the result thereof. Let us suppose that you know you are called. Experiencing the call, however rejoicing it may be, is in itself not yet redeeming. It points only to a typical organic condition in your personality. You possess the spirit spark atom, this exclusive hydrogen principle, in your heart sanctuary, and therefore you must react to the respective cosmic rays. There are countless people who oppose it for incarnations, denying their true state and clinging to dialectical nature. But there are also countless people who lose themselves in false mysticism as a reaction to that which moves them. How should we understand this? Suppose that you experience God's call and you talk about it, sing, write poems and otherwise give evidence of it, but for the rest remain exactly the same person as you were before. That is false mysticism. When you continuously say, "The Lord has called me," but take care to remain in the same old spot. When a pupil speaks effusively about his being called, or talks about the Brotherhood with a serene smile regarding what he feels in the heart, about the insight he receives, but at the same time does not show the slightest change in his mode of life, this is false mysticism. Just as a purring cat suddenly extends its claws in self-defense, viciously digging its nails into the victim's flesh, so many a person indulging in false mysticism will lash out and protest full of refusal and indignation when he or she is told that being called presumes a going of the path. The gnosis demands your entire self, the forsaking of your entire attachment to this nature. In response to its call, it requires the offer of your eye and the actual proofs thereof. False mysticism makes the grave error of imagining being called to be the end of the process, but being called is only an organic beginning, a kind of organic predisposition for the cosmic rays concerned. If, when called, one refuses to go the path, one inevitably falls prey to the countless negative currents attempting to shackle mankind permanently to the wheel. Every natural religion shows this characteristic and nourishes the ego drive. Now you can grasp the words of the Lord Jesus when he spoke, "Many are called, but few are chosen." Only when a called person goes the path consistently on the basis of his or her fundamental state of being, and when the calling light, as we said, becomes a lamp at one's feet, does the moment come for the first contact by the electromagnetic field of the cosmic septenary. Only then does one begin to be drawn, seized, chosen, Hautiki. One enters a new metabolic process. This too is neither compulsion nor a danger nor a premature birth in the new life, but rather the fulfillment of the parable saying, "And the father went out towards his son and embraced him and kissed him. Then the prodigal son has returned home." He had to go the two paths of the Rosicross, the path of dissolution and of resurrection. The precious jewel in the lotus radiates in the full brightness of a new morning. The candidate is resurrected in the new life. Every spirit spark entity is called to this resurrection. In closing, a few words regarding Revelation 17. There we read about the cosmic revolution, the agitation connected therewith, and the victory of the Lamb. In the 14th verse, we read that the victory will be shared by the faithful, those called and those chosen. The faithful are those who, although called, are not yet completely conscious of the fact, but still react spontaneously by approaching the spiritual school out of their innermost being. Those called are the ones who become conscious of their state of being and, awakening, make the decision to return. Those chosen are the ones who go the way of the cross and awaken reborn in the new morning. No matter on which of these three steps you stand at the present moment, if your motives are pure, your attitude in harmony with the demands, and your reaction accords with the great law, you will stand on the side of freedom during the progressive division in this world. We pray that you may share in this freedom that surpasses all understanding.